3, 2, 1.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning. This is Richard Cowan with the Steve Covey Show. Are you ready for freedom? Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. I'm ready for freedom. I'm totally ready for freedom. We got finally getting some sense in the court. The Supreme Court has told the judges that they can go back to being judges. They don't have to be lackeys for the drug warriors in Congress anymore.
It's interesting that that went through with only minimal noise from the usual suspects. I think that everyone has recognized again in this particular case, because this which involved crack cocaine, and it really did demonstrate the racial disparity here and the impact of that law. One of my pet peeves on this is that particular law was supported by most of the so-called African-American leadership in the United States, and this is something that, Julie Stewart at Families Against Mandatory Minimums is just really wonderful. Julie has been out there taking the lead on this. But again, everybody who's the victim of this has been black, and the people who have been championing this reform, the African-American leadership has just been completely acquiescent to the drug war. And I really find that offensive.
Well, I think everyone is clearly ready for change. Even Obama is trying to get some traction on, and I think he is, on the slogan, change we can believe in. Of course, we need change we need unbelievable change, change we couldn't dare to believe in if we're going to get out of the situation that we're in right now. But I'm very excited today, Richard, about David Nolan coming on the show. As you know, he's a founder of the Libertarian Party. The first meeting of the Libertarian Party was in his apartment in Colorado. David has gained recognition worldwide as a important intellectual. There was recently a award given to him out of England for one of the top 2,000 intellectuals today. David doesn't come across as an intellectual. He'll probably he's probably not happy that I'm casting him in this way, because he likes to see himself, and I think in many respects he is a down-to-earth kind of guy. But today I'm going to ask everyone to put on their crash helmets and buckle up, because David is going to take us places that few minds dare to go. One of the things that I find fascinating about David's various theories is the idea that history is cyclical. Now, this isn't his idea. There's a number of well-respected historians who subscribe to the notion that there is a historic pattern to the way people behave, that it takes us about 72 years or one generation to forget all the lessons that we learned from the previous generation. So David will be explaining his cyclical view of history and why this election in particular is an election that comes on the cusp of what a cyclical view of history would predict as a major paradigm shift. Now, David will get into this, but I wanted to tie this into the news, because aren't we all ready for a real change, Richard?
Well, I think the American people are really, you can see with, again, we talked about this before, Ron Paul, which I call him, the none of the above candidate, because clearly you have people across the political spectrum from, I've seen quite a number of people on, so to say, the progressive left, and they really are left, who are supporting Ron Paul simply because they see that they have been supportive of big government, but when big government ends up in the hands of George Bush, it suddenly scared them, and they realized that this is, you know, in fact, as George Washington said, you know, the government is a dangerous servant, a fearful master. And they suddenly realized this. And of course, you have the same thing with a lot of traditional conservatives who then are saying, oh my goodness, well, we've created this monstrous government, and we're about to turn it over to Hillary Clinton, which scares them to death. And so I think we've seen people across the political spectrum who really are, you know, desperate for something that is different.
Well, we saw Bob Barr abandon the Republican Party over this issue of government being out of control and make peace to some extent with those of us in the medical marijuana movement, because he recognizes that we're in the right and the federal government is in the wrong. Now, when David comes on the show, we're going to be talking about a number of things, but this all comes under the heading of the Ron Paul phenomenon. Mm-hmm. Several months ago, my campaign team and I huddled together to discuss what I described at the time as a tsunami, just an overwhelming flood of people that were signing on to the Ron Paul campaign. Not just signing on, but making it their campaign, opening up their wallet to do things on their own to help Ron Paul. So is this about Ron Paul? Not really. I mean, let's face it, Ron Paul is not the most charismatic individual. He's got somewhat of a high-pitched voice. He is not the game show host that we would like to see, that other people would like to see as president. No, it's Ron Paul's ideas that have people excited. And as you've pointed out, Richard, the fact that a lot of people have been badly frightened by how George Bush has gone about using government, we've educated, or rather George Bush has educated a lot of people and recruited them for us as closet or future libertarians. Well, David Nolan, as a founder of the Libertarian Party, as a highly respected intellectual thinker on the topic, as the inventor of the Nolan quiz, you know, that little quiz that you take that shows whether you're a right-winger, a left-winger, or a libertarian, that was his invention, and that's actually used by a lot of colleges and universities in their textbooks. So we're going to have David Nolan taking a broad view of history and what history has created in the way of a perfect storm, as well as his personal relationship with Ron Paul, his long-term association with the leaders of the freedom movement. If there's anyone that can really give us a real perspective, something that gives us the widest possible view with the least possible, hopefully, bias. I think David is about as objective as they come. This will give not just libertarians and policy advocates, activists, but Ron Paul supporters will have a chance to listen to this tape. It's available on demand 24/7. So they'll have a chance to get a grasp of something that all of us are being swept up into.
Well, you know, I think that the idea of cyclical history is, yes, obviously debatable because not everybody agrees with it, but I think that it is quite clear that we are at one of these tipping points, and it's a confluence of things, George Bush plus internet plus foreign problems plus the foreign opportunities, if you will, the things that are happening in India and China and so on that are changing the world.
Let's add to that list a substantial loss of credibility on the part of the mainstream media, who fell over each other to sign up for the opportunity to salute the flag and do all of their briefings from the Pentagon or the White House. And in retrospect, they look like true sycophants that just went for the party line, hook, line, and sinker. As a consequence, a lot of us just don't trust them anymore.
Well, we're so used to this in the so-called drug war that prohibitionist propaganda being passed off as journalism, and you know, where you know I've seen a number of very good things, you know, lately, basically just calling them the steno pool in the media, and you know they surprise, surprise, oh, they you know mainstream media acted as a steno pool for the Iraq war. Oh, really? Why? My goodness, that's never happened before, has it? You know, and you look at the you know, what's still going on in the New York Times and the Washington Post as far as stenographic reporting from whatever the drug war says. But yesterday, I thought it was a, you know, it was a, I saw, for example, a good article in the LA Times that was somewhat critical of the, you know, the latest declaration of victory in the drug war. And you know, it. You know, they saw the facts there, but they really couldn't quite get it all together. But I last night I posted on marijuananews.com a you know sort of an analysis of the numbers. But I think that one of the most important numbers there was that you know they were boasting about how teen marijuana use went down by 25% during the Bush administration. Well, the fact is that cigarette smoking by teens went down by 33%, and all without arresting a single adult for possession of cigarettes.
So if we were cigarette companies and we wanted to reduce cigarettes, we'd endorse it as an illegal product. Because that's really the only lure at this point. For the kids, because they're under so much pressure not to associate with marijuana, not to associate with marijuana people, and they're being forced into another world of prescription drugs, far more dangerous, far more deadly than they would be facing.
Among teens went up by 30%. And
hey, I hate to interrupt you. We only got a couple of minutes to go before David comes on to talk about Ron Paul. And I wanted to talk about USAstrawpolls.com, which is a website that is archiving the straw poll results leading to the 2008 presidential election. Now, guess what, Richard? They found out that Ron Paul has just surpassed Fred Thompson as the sole leader in straw poll victories.
Hmm.
Now, the straw polls are not a scientific measure of support, but they are highly touted, as you know, by those who win them as evidence that they're dominating the political landscape. Ron Paul is dominating the political landscape. He's not bragging about it, but here is USAstrawpolls.com doing the bragging for him.
Straw polls, I think, are a measure of one thing, and that is the intensity factor. That
yes.
How strongly people feel about something or other. That it's always funny when for example, Lou Dobbs did a poll on marijuana, and you know he's an ardent prohibitionist, and anybody who disagrees with him is stupid. And so he does you know he's one of his polls on air. To, you know if you're you know and 90% of his viewers disagreed with him.
He must be a cigarette smoker. He must be addicted to nicotine, because I noticed that when he talks, his teeth are badly stained.
Well, maybe because since he can't smoke while he's on the air, maybe that accounts for a lot of his behavior. The poor dear is going through withdrawal. That's what it is. The guy just needs to take a hit on an unfiltered Camel. Maybe that's what he does during the commercials or something, or slap another nicotine patch on it.
Now, some people are saying Ron Paul is not a true libertarian. How would you respond to that, Richard?
Well, you know, I think that if you turn use the term big tent libertarian. I think that I'm not sure that I am a pure libertarian. I'm not a plumb line libertarian. I'm sort of a plumb nuts libertarian. But I think that. You know, the idea is that if people really do recognize that government is, again, quoting Washington, a dangerous servant and a fearful master. I think that that really is, I would say, the beginning of wisdom. And the real question for me has always been, how the hell do we get out of this mess? Because, you know, Ron Paul talks about, so for example, abolishing the Federal Reserve or this, that, or the other. But really and truly, it is, you know, if we had a libertarian president and a libertarian Congress confronted with the present mess, I don't think that they could find, you know, an immediate libertarian solution. So the question is, how pragmatic, you know, as opposed to ideological, you know, anybody can be when they suddenly are in a position of power and responsibility. So I think, yes, I think Ron Paul is a real libertarian, and his emphasis on, you know, I for example, people say that, you know, he is, you know, George Kelly yesterday pointed out rightly that Paul is pro-life. Paul is a practicing Roman Catholic and an OBGYN who is strongly against abortion.
Richard, if I could just interrupt a minute, we should have heard from David by now. He might be having some problems, so I'd like to go off the air for just a minute.
Okay.
Call David.
I see no caller here, but go ahead and call him, and then I will amuse the public while you're gone. That's
good.
My next number. prepare for one of Richard Callen's rants. No, you know, this is something that, you know, in terms of what is a libertarian, you know, I think that my problem, for example, with Bob Barr, there we go, I see that we do have David Nolan here, so.
Yes, I'm here.
Good morning, David.
Hello.
This is Richard Callen.
Hello, Richard.
Yeah, Steve.
Good to talk to you in a while.
Yeah, indeed. Good to talk to you. Steve had gone to fetch you, so Steve, come back. But while anyway, good morning, and we wanted to talk to you about the present situation in America and the sudden prominence of libertarianism. I mean, gosh and golly, unaccustomed as we are to public speaking, this is really a new situation for us, isn't it?
Well, kind of. I assume you're referring to what people are calling the Ron Paul Revolution, with Representative
mm-hmm.
Paul attracting a great deal of interest in his bid for the Republican Party's nomination, and I wish him all the best in that, but to be honest, I don't think his chances of obtaining that nomination are really very good, because the Republican Party establishment, which is mostly neoconservatives and evangelicals, are dead set against letting anybody like Ron Paul get anywhere near their nomination.
The interesting about that is that also, when you think about it, though, that Ron Paul is a devout Roman Catholic.
No, he's not. He's a Southern Baptist.
Oh, I thought he was Roman.
No, he's
Catholic.
Not a Catholic. He's a Baptist.
Oh, I'm sorry. But if all that, which makes the point even stronger, though, is that, you know, and he is pro-life, and, you know, basically has, you know, very traditional values. And so, what exactly is the problem then? That the evangelical right in the Republican Party have with him, and you know, of course, then again you have to wonder about Pat Robertson endorsing Giuliani. I mean, so
well, Pat Robertson is kind of the voice of the past. I don't think he's even a major player in the evangelical community anymore. He's been, sort of supplanted by people like Dobson of Focus on the Family, and some of the newer evangelicals. Robertson was a force to be reckoned with, say, a quarter century ago, but he's kind of been bypassed. I think the reason the evangelicals are not behind Ron Paul is that although he is personally pro-life, he takes the stance that it's not a federal issue. He's actually on that issue somewhat of a moderate. He's pro-life, but he's not in favor of a constitutional amendment to declare that human rights begin at conception. So the evangelicals think he's not quite pro-life enough, but the people who are more socially liberal or progressive think that he's too pro-life or too conservative on social issues. I think the real problem that he will have in making a lot of headway towards the Republican nomination, and again, I should stress, I wish him the best. I would love to see him win that nomination.
Yes.
The real opposition comes from the ruling clique in the Republican Party, the neocons, who have a very aggressive, global intervention-oriented foreign policy, and of course Ron Paul stands firmly against that. If you've watched any of those Republican debates, including the one just yesterday, you'll have a whole bunch of them lined up on the stage, and only Ron Paul speaks out against the Bush administration's foreign policy, which is really a continuation of the foreign policy of prior administrations. The general approach of most Republican politicians is, you know, we must go out there and protect America against fanatical Islamic radicals. They believe, I think sincerely most of them, that if we don't take the battle to them, that they will bring the battle to us, as they did on 9/11. Ron Paul is the sole dissenter. He says, no, the reason they attacked us is because we have been over there meddling in the Middle East since World War II, and if we revert to a traditional American foreign policy of a friendship with all and entangling alliances with none, and we don't stick our nose in around the world, and we don't have 700 bases around the world, if we weren't constantly meddling in the affairs of the rest of the world, they would leave us alone, and we could all get along pretty well. Now, that may or may not be true, but that's the fundamental divide between Ron Paul and the rest of the Republican Party.
Well, welcome to the show, David. I'm back.
You're back. Was that you that tried to beat me on the other line about a minute ago?
Yes.
I figured so.
Well, I want to say that I spoke just before the show with a Ron Paul campaign worker in Tennessee who drove all night to hand deliver endorsements for electors. And they are very, very serious in Ron Paul territory about signing up Republican electors to elect Ron Paul.
You mean delegates. Electors or delegates?
Well, they call them electors.
Are you talking about the people whose names will appear on the ballot in November? Or are you talking about people who will go to the Republican convention and choose the nominee?
That's right. The people latter. That will be going to the nomination to choose a nominee are being recruited very, very rigorously and enthusiastically by the Ron Paul campaign team.
I think that's great. I still think the odds are heavily against him. I think what's going to happen, and I'll go on the record now, is I think he will place third or fourth in Iowa when they caucus there on January 3rd. I think he will place third or fourth in New Hampshire, possibly second, on January 8th. And thereafter, his support will fade in the sense that you've got to have more name recognition and more money and more endorsements to make it through the Super Tuesday mega primary on February 5th. And I think the better known candidates like Giuliani and the people with tons of money like Romney and the people with long standing national recognition like John McCain will simply overwhelm him when it comes to having to compete in, I don't know, it's something like 18 states on one day, and I don't think that he'll be able to make it past that primary. I hope he does, but I think the Ron Paul revolution, as far as its effect within the Republican Party, will be pretty much over as of February 6th. That's my guess. I'm not happy about that, but I think that's the way it's going to go down.
One of the interesting possibilities is that the Republicans will go into their convention for the first time in a very long time without somebody, you know, having a lock on it. And they really, I gather, if I was listening to people talk about this, is they don't really have the kind of rules set up that's going to make a convention, an open convention, operate very smoothly. But if they all get up there and can't arrive at a consensus, and they're used to, someone said, having a coronation, not a convention, then this is going to be a very interesting time, which could open it up to everyone, and including, I suggested, even the possibility of Newt Gingrich.
That's what I'd like to interject in here with David. that you have been telling me for over 10 years, that we were headed towards a transitional tipping point, if you will, a paradigm shift that we've historically seen occurring in the United States every approximately 72 years.
That is correct.
Would you talk about that a little bit and get the audience on the same
page? Yeah, I'd be glad to. Let me just address the point Richard was raising. That is a possibility. I don't know how good of a possibility. It will be the first time since, I believe, 1952 that situation has occurred, if it does in fact occur. And anything could happen at such a convention, but realistically, I don't think it's going to happen. I can't say for sure that it won't happen. None of us can. I think it's a possibility, but a relatively small one. Back to your question, Steve, I started pointing out in the early 1990s, maybe even the late 1980s, that major tipping points, as you call them, or paradigm shifts, or whatever you want to call it, occur in the United States approximately every 72 years. Most people, if you ask them who were the three most influential or important presidents in American history, will name George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, and Franklin D. Roosevelt. Whether or not you like those men and what they did, most people, most historians will agree that they were the three
pivotal,
most important or most influential presidents in American history, and their elections occurred 72 years apart, Washington in 1788, Lincoln in 1860, and FDR in 1932. Well, if you project that forward another 72 years, you come to 2004, and we did not see such an occurrence in 2004, but certainly 4 years is a relatively small margin of error on a cycle of that length, and it does now appear very likely that such an occurrence is about to happen again in 2008. Which way it will go, how it will fall out, that's very interesting. The Ron Paul revolution, I think, is a manifestation of that, because you are seeing a real realignment of political forces occasioned by Dr. Paul and his campaign. You've got people that normally would not have come together, but you've got people who are unhappy with U.S. foreign policy and the Iraq war in particular, which segues into people concerned about the erosion of civil liberties, younger voters who foresee the bankruptcy of Social Security, people who understand instinctively that our monetary system is rotten, and people who oppose the federal income tax for all the obvious reasons. That's a broad group of constituencies, some of whom traditionally would have been considered conservatives, some of whom traditionally would have been considered liberal. They're all coming together behind Ron Paul, which is great. Again, I think institutionally the Republican Party is rigged against him. I've maintained in public and in private for quite some time that I think Ron Paul's chances of getting elected president would be considerably better as a third-party candidate in a three-way or four-way race than his chances of obtaining the Republican Party nomination going through their internal processes, caucuses, primaries, and convention. Unfortunately, he seems to have pretty much ruled out that possibility. And he may change his mind, but I'm going to take him at his word. He apparently sincerely doesn't want to do that. And that's unfortunate, because that could be the vehicle which could provide the opportunity for that major paradigm shift. That coalition would remain intact, and although it might not be a majority of the voters, it could easily be a plurality of the voters in many states, particularly in the West.
I think the whole thing of the numbers of the that would have an impact on, for example, the left is turned on Ralph Nader after Nader effectively cost Al Gore the election. And if Ron Paul were to mount a third party, real challenge, based in the Libertarian Party, what would the impact would that have on the Electoral College and the outcome of the election? And would that have the effect of who would benefit? Would it be the Democrats or the Republicans? Who would lose the most votes if Ron Paul were the Libertarian Party candidate?
That's a very good question, and I'll answer it obliquely, because I don't think it's as simple as saying who would lose the most votes, because for the most part, I believe, most of the people, or a very large percentage of the people who would vote for Ron Paul, are people who would otherwise stay home and not vote at all. I think we always have to be very careful of saying, who will he take votes away from? In many cases, these are people that wouldn't have voted. He's not taking away from anyone. If he's in the race, he'll bring new people in rather than taking out people who would otherwise vote Republican or Democrat. I think it's very important to remember. But that said, I think it's within the realm of possibility that Ron Paul, running as an independent or libertarian candidate, could carry the entire western United States, by which I mean west of 104th latitude, except for California and New Mexico. Add in Alaska and New Hampshire, you've got about 64, 65 electoral votes, which would probably prevent either of the other two parties from obtaining a majority. We would then have an electoral deadlock for the first time since 1800. And at that point, I think one or the other of the two candidates would try to strike a deal with Ron Paul to put him on the ticket and saying, my electors will vote for you for vice president if your electors will vote for me as president. If his electoral vote is even larger, it's possible he could cut a deal with one of them and saying, we'll do it the other way. If your guys will vote for me for president, I'll put your candidate on as vice president. So that's a scenario that's possible, not highly likely, but well within the realm of possibility.
Well, I have a scenario I think is a lot more likely that I'd like to ask you about, although I think that's certainly a very provocative scenario that you just outlined. But I'm picturing Ron Paul being defeated in the GOP. He hasn't taken the steps that he needed to right now, early on, to prepare for a third-party run by getting ballot access.
He said he's not going to do that.
We should take him at his word.
Right.
But what I think is very likely is that there will be a write-in campaign across the country. I don't know the rules regarding write-ins. Has there ever been any historical effort to write in candidates at the presidential level?
No, and let me tell you why. Because when you go into the voting booth on election day and you vote in the presidential election, technically you are not voting for Rudy Giuliani or Ron Paul. You are voting for a slate of electors. So people simply going in and saying, writing down, Ron Paul or Steve Cubby or Dave Nolan or any other name, effectively their vote would not count because they have not specified a slate of electors. And that's technically who you are voting for. A presidential candidate must name his or her slate of electors in every state where their name appears on the ballot. And even though most people don't realize it, when you pull that lever, you're not voting for the candidate, you're voting for the slate of electors, and they are, in theory, independent agents. They don't have to vote for the person whose name.
Now, I know that happened once.
It's happened 11 times
in
history. And
but once for a libertarian.
Right. The first and only time that a libertarian candidate, or two candidates, John Hospers and Tony Nathan, received electoral votes was when Roger McBride, elected as a Republican elector in 1972, bolted from the Republican ticket as a protest against the Nixon administration and voted for Hospers and Nathan, crossed out the preprinted names on the ballot in Virginia where he was an elector and wrote in Hospers and Nathan, which made Toni Nathan the first woman to ever receive an electoral vote, well before Geraldine Ferraro got some electoral votes a few years later. So technically you're voting for electors, and that's why any scenario that you look at has to hinge on not only how many states could somebody carry. I think Ron Paul could carry up to 20 million votes if 120 million people vote in the election. That's 1 in 6, so that's pretty commensurate with what other significant third-party candidates like Perot, Wallace, and La Follette received in their respective elections. I can see Ron Paul getting 20 million votes. That won't do him any good if they're spread out so that he gets 16% of the vote everywhere, but that's not the way it'll happen. He'll get very low votes in some areas and very high votes in others, and that's why I project that even with 20 million votes, he could carry the western U.S., except probably for California and New Mexico, which are pretty liberal states and typically go Democrat, and I think that's pretty unlikely. Now, you look at those states, and most of those are states that whose electoral votes would normally go Republican, but not entirely. Look at Washington, Oregon, Arizona, those are all swing states.
That's really is an interesting analysis because and it seems though, of course, again, it's not going to happen because he says it. I think that not only his words but his actions suggest that that's not what he's going to do.
I agree.
And I think that
what is he going to do, David?
What is Ron Paul going to do, assuming he does not get the Republican nominee?
Yes,
he has said when asked, and I personally asked him face to face back in March when he spoke at a fundraiser in Phoenix. He says he will run for his seat in Congress again in Texas, where he has seniority, where he has a constituency, and it'll be pretty easy for him to be reelected. At least that's what he believes. And it's probably strategically a sound decision. He continues to remain the foremost consistent voice for liberty in the U.S. representative.
Any chance he would run for senator?
I don't know. You asked me what is he likely to do. He says what he's likely to do is run again for U.S. rep, and I'll take that at face value.
I think we should, yes.
Yeah. I think you also remember, Paul is 72 years old, and so
right.
He's in great shape, obviously.
He seems to have more energy than I would. I don't think I could keep up the schedule that he has, and I'm 64.
No, well, certainly nor I. We've got some callers on the line here. Let me see if Paul, not Ron Paul, is 415-690. Hello, are you with us, Paul? Nope. Go ahead.
I was wondering how you see this moving forward into the future for what kind of long-term effects we'll have.
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Are you talking specifically about the Ron Paul movement?
Yeah, that's
the point. I'm very much concerned that once it becomes evident that he's not going to be the Republican nominee, which I'm afraid is the way it's going, I think the Ron Paul movement will wind down pretty quickly. I think an awful lot of people who are very excited about Dr. Paul, for all the right reasons, are going to, when they see that he doesn't have a chance at the Republican nomination and that he's not going to run as a third-party candidate, will just sort of drop out and go back to doing whatever they do in their lives. I don't think that the energy and the focus of the Ron Paul revolution can be kept alive once Ron Paul himself is out of the picture.
That doesn't speak well as a libertarian movement, not to talk about the Libertarian Party, but if we can't, given the internet, I wonder, David, if you're right about that. I mean, obviously.
Isn't it likely that we would see a similar evolution as what we saw with MoveOn.org?
Very good. You took the words right out of my mouth, Steve. We saw the Howard Dean campaign evolve into, or actually, MoveOn came out of the era of the Clinton impeachment. But it is possible, and I don't know if Ron Paul's campaign people have given it much thought. I know from what I've heard secondhand, third hand, a lot of them would like him to stay in the race beyond February or March because, they'd like to keep their jobs. They enjoy what they're doing. They feel they're doing something exciting and important, and of course they're getting a paycheck, and they would like to see the campaign continue, whether it's as a third-party effort or not. And if he won't run as a third-party candidate, as a libertarian or an independent or there's talk of trying to get him the nomination of the Unity 08 group, which is really kind of a paper tiger, but it's got some recognition, that they may in fact try to convert the enthusiasm and the meetup groups into some kind of ongoing long-standing operation like MoveOn.org. That's a possibility. How likely it is to succeed, I honestly don't know.
What is the magnetism of the Ron Paul blimp? Does it symbolize somehow getting this off the ground?
When I first read about that, I thought, well, it's a project that's been put together by some people as an independent campaign. It's not directly affiliated with the Ron Paul campaign for reasons having to do mostly with FEC regulations. It is truly an independent effort. And I looked at it and I kind of shook my head and went, what's that all about? I honestly don't believe that that's going to be a cost-effective use of the money that they're spending. I understand it's going to cost $350,000 a month plus overhead, and so they're planning on trying to raise $500,000 a month. Maybe they'll succeed.
Well, what about the plan to do a flyover on the Super Bowl?
That won't happen because of Homeland Security regulations. That's a restricted air zone. Maybe they're trying
that
to
idea
get.
Won't fly.
What, Richard?
I said that idea won't fly.
Exactly. I mean, I think, you know, like a lot of ideas that are being floated and tested by Ron Paul supporters, many of them are unsophisticated in the sense that people don't know the limits imposed by, you know, reality in terms of legal requirements, financial requirements, et cetera. It's a fun thing if the people who give the money are happy to have their money spent that way. Go for it.
But, what about the money bombs? That was impressive.
Well, we got another one. They've got another one. Somebody is organizing another one for next week, December 16th.
Bill of Rights Day.
I think it's the schedule for the 16th, isn't it?
Boston
yes.
Tea Party.
A Boston Tea Party, right. They say, I've heard that over 20,000 people have already signed up somewhere, committed to donating on that day, and if they donate $100 each, as happened last time, that's already a couple million dollars. They're hoping to raise more than the 4.2 or 4.3 million they raised in November. Again, I certainly hope so, because the more money that is raised for the Ron Paul campaign, the stronger that makes him in terms of being able to compete head-on in that plethora of primaries on February 5th. The one thing he may have going for him is that although he hasn't raised quite as much money, anywhere near as much money as some of the front runners, it's been very cost effective. The $4 million that they got on November 5th cost them essentially nothing. And a traditional candidate, somebody like whether it's, you know, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or Rudy Giuliani, will typically have to raise $8 million to net $4 million because half of it's lost in fundraising costs. So the fact that Ron Paul has now raised something like close to $20 million total since entering the race at the beginning of the year, that's really understates the level of financial support he's been able to generate. That's the equivalent of $30 or $40 million by most candidates, because most of them would have spent, you know, $10 or $20 million to raise it. And he's got a lot of money in the bank, and if they raise another $2, $3 million or more on the 16th, that puts them, that gives them, I don't know how many millions in the war chest, and they can go out to states that follow New Hampshire. They can go out to Nevada, and I've forgotten which state is next, I think Michigan, and compete on a fairly level playing field. So we can't rule out the possibility that Ron Paul will do credibly and stay in the race beyond February 5th. I think the odds are against it, but only time will tell.
What is your thoughts about this new development that, for lack of a better word, people call, well, I think it's actually a great word, the money bomb?
Well, it's interesting. It's the next step forward in, you know, the evolution of politics in the Internet age. Howard Dean led the way 4 years ago, and now the grassroots have taken it a step further as the media have just now finally begun to realize this isn't quite like what Howard Dean did in 2003 and 2004, where they organized a drive to raise money on the Internet. This happened totally spontaneously. The Ron Paul campaign did not organize these fundraising efforts. They were arranged by people who just said, wouldn't it be cool to raise money for Ron Paul, and just set up an independent project to do it and told people where to go to make their donation. So this is an extremely spontaneous development, and in the long run, that shows what can be done. And Richard, I think it was you asked earlier, what is the long-range implication of the Ron Paul campaign, or maybe it was the gentleman who called in. If nothing else, it shows that more and more the political process is going to be driven by individuals acting spontaneously and less controlled by the party establishments.
Well, I agree with that, and of course that's a healthy thing. We're finally,
yes.
Well, the Internet changes everything, and the effect that it's having on politics, like everything else, is to reduce the vertical pyramids and power structures and flatten it out to horizontal networks.
Well, that's very true, and you're seeing a similar development, not as phenomenal, not as pronounced as the Ron Paul revolution, but you're seeing on the Democratic side, it now appears that there's going to be a real fight for the nomination there. I always assumed it was going to be the reincarnate Hillary, and the game was over almost before it began because all the party powerful people in the Democratic Party, excuse me, I get them mixed up, they're so similar, all the power players in the Democratic Party were beholden to the Clintons, either because of, you know, the Clintons were blackmailing them or they owed them favors or whatever. And it was assumed that Hillary was unstoppable. Just in the last couple of weeks, people are talking about the fact that Obama is running neck and neck with her in the early primary states. And his support has been largely generated on the Internet and spontaneously. And that's interesting as well. I think his chances of getting the Democratic nomination are a little better than Ron Paul's chances of getting the nomination on the Republican side. But both of those campaigns are demonstrating the shape of things to come. And in 2012 and beyond, more and more, we're going to see that kind of process where the people will actually choose their party's nominees. And eventually, the political parties, as we know them, may fade away because they won't be needed anymore. And by eventually, I mean 12 or 16 years out.
Well, maybe that's the fundamental paradigm shift that we're witnessing.
Could be.
It is there. Yeah,
it isn't necessarily the election of one individual, but the fundamental change in the rules of engagement, because the pyramids are now being replaced by networks.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
We've got another caller here who's been holding for a good bit. Let's bring him in and see 704. There we go. Are you with us?
Yes, I am. Yes, can you hear me?
We can hear you.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to your comments about the Electoral College. I think you just made a good argument for going to direct democracy. Because I wasn't aware, you know, what's the purpose of having a write-in candidate if it doesn't matter?
Well,
why is it even on the ballot if, you know, it's not going to do anybody any good? I don't understand.
Maybe you could start, David, by describing the original intent of the Founding Fathers.
Well, the Electoral College was created back in the 18th century, you know, in the late 1700s, because at that time we had no mass communications, we had no rapid transportation, and the idea was that the great majority of people who would vote for a president had never met, never seen, never heard that candidate.
Right.
So what they would do is they would gather in their respective states, and they would vote for people whom they trusted and said, you go and convene somewhere, originally in Philadelphia and each in their respective states, excuse me, and choose the best of the candidates according to your knowledge and abilities. And these were usually well-connected, well-informed citizens, and people essentially entrusted the decision-making process to those people as an intermediary group. Nowadays, it can be argued, for structural reasons, the Electoral College is no longer valid or no longer necessary. We'll probably never get rid of it, because in order to get rid of it, you'd have to have a constitutional amendment, and the constitutional amendment must be approved by 3/4 of the states, and there are more than 1/4 of the states who benefit from the Electoral College in the sense that the way it's structured, small states get proportionately greater say in the process. A very small state that has only 3 or 4 electoral votes, each elector represents something like 200,000 people, and in large states like New York, Texas, and California, they represent 500,000 or 600,000 people. So the small states have a vested interest in maintaining the electoral system.
You know, I think that that's a part of a broader question here. As people, we talk about democracy because it's the system that we trying to perfect. But the fact is that the U.S. Constitution is really, in some ways, a profoundly anti-democratic document, because the founders were distrustful of popular passions, and so they put all kinds of brakes, the Senate being a perfect example of that, the most extreme example of that other than the Electoral College. And here we are at a time when we're talking about, again, the going beyond political parties because of the Internet, and the idea that we're trying to get an 18th century document which is going to be, as you said, David, extremely hard to amend, and work it with a 21st century technology and entirely new political systems of, or, you know, at the grassroots that were so different from what the founders contemplated. And I think, obviously, Jefferson and Franklin would love it. Hamilton and Adams would be absolutely appalled. But this is something that basically we're going to have to work around in this process. And that, you know, there are other ways, for example, of having the electors. In fact, I think Colorado already has this system, or one of the states does, where the electors represent congressional districts. And our my late friend Roger McBride was a supporter of that, as I recall.
Well, that system has its merits, but again, consider the fact that in almost every state, the congressional districts are deliberately gerrymandered to favor one party or another, and that probably would just simply lock it. Basically, what that would do, with you know some margin for error, is basically that would almost assure that whoever carried a majority of the of the congressional districts would also carry the presidency. That would rule out for almost forever, the idea that you might have a president representing one party and a Congress dominated by the other. And I think that's a good thing. You know, libertarians like to say gridlock is good. If they're not able to rush things through, it slows them down, them being the people who always want to increase government power. So I don't think a congressional system is a particularly good modification. A better one would be to apportion each state's electoral vote in according to the popular vote. In other words, in California, which has something like 58 or 60 electors, if the Democrats got 60% of the vote, they'd get 60% of the electoral vote, which might be like 34, and the Republicans would get 24 or whatever. That would greatly reduce the sway that large states like California, Texas, and New York have, and of course they resist that, just as the small states resist giving up the electoral system because they are overrepresented in the Electoral College. But pure democracy is not necessarily a good thing. As you pointed out, Richard, the founding fathers were very concerned with that, and I don't know who it was, probably Twain or Mencken or somebody like that, who said democracy is two foxes and a chicken voting on what we're having for dinner.
Well, I like to say that I've traditionally always been an independent. I've never played into partisan politics or anything like that. But I, because I love Ron Paul's message so much, I register as a Republican just so I can vote in the primaries. And I like to say that if he does not get the Republican nomination and if he chooses not to run as a third-party candidate, I have made a promise to myself that I'm leaving this country because, you know, I'm a United States veteran. I served in the military 6 years. I was in the first Gulf War. And I just think that this country is just headed in the wrong direction, and I do not like a lot of the things that I see out of
both. I have one question for you. But before I ask this question, I want to preface it by telling you that Richard Cowan and I just returned from 5 years of living outside of the United States in defiance of the United States, and we learned that the power of the United States to twist any jurisdiction, any police force, any judge, any court is so completely overwhelming that you can't escape it. So I'm interested, if you don't mind, on what jurisdiction you believe would be safest for you.
Well, I have a 2-year plan, if Ron Paul isn't elected president, to go to Ghana, Africa.
Well, that might work. It's sure not Canada.
African American?
Excuse me?
Are you African American?
Yes.
Okay, so I understand. Okay. Why the choice of Ghana is interesting. Why Ghana?
Because it's one of the more developed countries in Africa. They also offer free land to African Americans as a form of reparations for slavery, and they're actually asking for a lot of educated African Americans to come there. It's an English-speaking country, and they're asking a lot of African Americans to come there to help build that country up. I don't want to leave America. I love America. America is my home. But with the Patriot Act and other anti-freedom legislations that has been coming down the pipe, I just don't see people being free anymore in this country if the political establishment is allowed to continue on the course that it is.
Well, I would like to persuade you that change is at hand, that people across this country feel as you do, and that the time has come not to run, but to stand for what we believe in. We're a majority, a big majority in this country. I seriously doubt if the opposition composes more than 20%. I think the reason that the opposition wins elections is that they're huddled around fear, and we usually have a number of options so that people split the vote. But if Ron Paul is not the nominee, I am going to run as a nominee. And whatever votes we cast, that is a clear protest vote. And the more people that we can get to vote their conscience instead of voting as if it's a horse race, the more the American public and the parties will understand that a shift has occurred and that they have to respond to that. So as appealing as it might be to leave this country right now, I say to you, you've served your country with honor and distinction in the past. Please continue to serve it, because we need you now more than ever.
Well, you are the Ron Paul revolution, in a sense.
Well, I'd just like to see more people stand up. We just have so many people in this country that are just brainwashed, and they let the media dictate their reality.
They're waking up. They're rubbing their eyes. They've seen what George Bush can do to a government, and they're waking up, and they're ready to join us.
And well, also, particularly appeals to you as an African-American, because we truly do need more people in the African-American community. I'm as white as you get, but Martin Luther King is my hero, because Martin Luther King stood up for freedom and fighting back against what seemed at the time overwhelming odds. And this is something that I really think that we need more African American leadership in the libertarian movement, the freedom movement. Earlier, I don't know if you were listening, but
I'll tell you right now, if you want to join the Libertarian Party, I will certainly escort you through the next convention and introduce you as a personal friend, because we desperately need people such as yourself in the party.
But he's got to stay Republican long enough to vote for Ron Paul, right?
Right. Right. Well,
there'll be a lot of other registered Republicans at the Libertarian Convention, I assure you.
Well, I think Ron Paul's message is reaching the African-American community. I have a show here on Blog Talk Radio, and I'm certainly speaking on the things that he's speaking on. I mean, he's more pro-African-American as far as our issues go than Barack Obama, who thinks that African-Americans have come 95% of the way here in America. And Ron Paul, he stated that when he looks at statistical data such as the disparities in sentencing and things of that nature, that, you know, that is not right. And he's spoken out against it, where, you know, you have these African-Americans in the Democratic Party that, you know, frankly, I think that they are bought and paid for by the establishment.
In many cases,
what is the name
true.
Of your What is the name of your program on Blog Talk Radio?
It is One Black Man's View.
One Black right. Man's Blog Talk Radio. One Black Man's View. Well, I really do appreciate. We're as then you're familiar with the countdown here, and I'm looking at here. It says 1 minute remaining. So I really want to thank you for joining us, and thank everyone.
I want to invite you back. I'd like to have you on the show.
Well, certainly. Please just get in contact with me, and thanks for taking my call.
Great.
Thank you so much.
And David, thank you so much. What a fantastic ride through a strange world you've taken us on.
Well, it's always fun talking with you, Steve, and probably we'll be doing this again before too many more weeks and months go by. I'm sure we'll talk at least a couple times between now.
One quick question.
Yeah.
Who's the next president going to be?
Oh, boy. When you asked me that question about 6 months ago, 5-6 months ago, Steve, I said that if I had to put money on the table, betting against the field, I'd pick Fred Thompson because I saw him as the most likely Republican nominee.
Well, sure, he was a movie star. He's been in the Senate.
And the
running
and
out of time,
never
gentlemen.
Forget.
But he's just too tired out with that young wife of his to.
Well, the electoral, always remember, again, the Electoral College system favors the Republican Party. That's how Bush has been able to get elected twice. And so, you know, depending on who the Republican's nominee is, I would tend to bet on the Republican, but it would be a tough call.
Thank you.
We'll
David.
See you back here real soon, David. Thanks.
Inhale the smoke, leave Santa a toll.